Side 12. Ilium by Dan Simmons. Continuing on page 356. The crawler filled the space like some giant spider. Its six wheels, each at least 12 feet tall, linked by hinged, spidery struts. Its passenger sphere glowing milkily in the center of the struts like a white egg at the center of a web. The battering against the church doors and walls began even before Savi began climbing the thin, metallic access ladder hanging from the struts. "Hurry," she said, no longer whispering. Third in line, again, Demon thought that the old woman was the master of the unnecessary imperative. A boarded window 60 feet up a wall exploded inward and 5 Voyniks scrabbled in, their bladed manipulators hacking into stone like ice hammers. The eyeless, rust-red domes above their carapaces turned ponderously downward and fixed on the crawler and the 3 people trying to get to its passenger sphere. Stones burst from the far wall, and 6 other Voyniks came in on 2 legs. Savi touched a faded red circle on the underside of the sphere, tapped digits into a small yellow energy disky that appeared, and a section of the glass globe slid open with an audible rasp. She crawled up and in. Harmon followed, and Demon got his legs in just as the first of the Voyniks hurtled across the dusty stones toward him. The slice in the sphere slid closed. There were 6 cracked leather contour seats in the center of the sphere, and he and Harmon threw themselves into side seats as Savi ran her hand over a flat metal wedge protruding above the front seat. A softly glowing projection control panel, much more complicated than the one on the Sony, pulsed into life around her. She touched a virtual red dial, ran a bright yellow circle along a green slide, and slipped her hand into a form-fitting controller. "What if it doesn't start?" asked Harmon, whom Demon now nominated for master of the poorly timed rhetorical question. A score of Voyniks pulled themselves up and over the high black mesh wheels and jumped like giant grasshoppers onto the top of the glass sphere. Demon flinched and ducked low. "If it doesn't start, we die," said Savi. She twitched the virtual controller to the right. There was no engine roar or gyro hum, just a soft buzz, so low as to be almost subsonic. But searchlights stabbed out in front of the crawler, and 12 other virtual displays flicked into life. The 6 Voyniks atop the passenger sphere had been pounding and clawing on the glass, but suddenly they slid away and fell to the ground 20 feet below. They weren't injured or damaged. Each Voynik leapt to its feet and jumped for the sphere again, but each then fell away again, unable to gain purchase on the surface they'd been clinging to only a few seconds earlier. "It's a micron-thick force field," muttered Savi, her attention on the glowing designs and icons appearing all over the virtual panel. "Frictionless. It was designed to keep snow or rain from accumulating on the canopy, but it appears to shed Voyniks as well." Demon turned to watch a score of Voyniks scrambling up the huge wheels, battering at the metal mesh, pulling at the struts and braces. "We should go," he said. "Yes." Savi pushed the virtual controller forward and the crawler crashed through the ancient church wall, fell 12 feet before the wildly articulated wheels found purchase on the wall and ground, and then accelerated forward. The lane was slightly narrower than the crawler, but this didn't slow the machine a bit. Walls several thousand years old collapsed on either side until the crawler lurched out onto David Street, and Savi turned it left, toward the west, away from the blue beam still stabbing skyward behind them. Countless Voyniks scrabbled in pursuit while dozens more threw themselves in front of the speeding crawler and leapt for the passenger sphere. Still accelerating, the crawler ran over those in the street that failed to dodge and left the rest of the pack behind. 6 persistent Voyniks still clung to the struts and were hacking away at the metal, clawing at the spinning wheels. "Can they do damage?" asked Harmon. "I don't know," said Savi. "We're approaching the Shor Yaffa, the Jaffa Gate. Let's see if we can get rid of them." She swerved the still accelerating crawler into walls on the left and then on the right side of David Street, finally smashing through an arch lower than the crawler. Vibration and falling masonry shook the clinging Voyniks off, but Demon turned to see most of them rising out of the rubble and joining the pack giving chase. And then the crawler was through the gate, out of the old city and picking up speed down the graveled hill where they'd left the Sony, but the only sign of their flying machine was a heap of rocks 30 feet high, surrounded by 40 or 50 more Voyniks. Immediately the creatures left the mound and rushed to cut off the crawler. Savi ran over some, dodged others, and found an ancient highway running west from the city. "Tough machine," said Harmon. "They built tough machines toward the end of the Lost Age," said Savi. "With nano-maintenance, it should last damn near forever." She'd pulled her thermskin night-vision lenses from her pack and was driving with the crawler's headlights off now. Demon found the effect of hurtling along in the dark unsettling as he heard the big wheels crunching over rusted artifacts on the road. Probably ancient abandoned vehicles. Then he realized that they were hurtling over a bridge and then rumbling through a cut between hills. He couldn't see the pursuing Voyniks now in the dark, only the receding blue blade of light leaping straight up from the dark hill of Jerusalem. But he knew the Voyniks were still back there, still coming on. Savi told them that it was about 30 miles to the coastline of the former Mediterranean Sea. They made the distance in less than 10 minutes. "Look at this," said Savi, slowing the crawler. She removed her night vision glasses and flicked on the headlights, fog lights, and searchlights. A mass of 500 or 600 Voyniks had made a wedge near where the land suddenly tilted down into the dry Mediterranean basin. "Do we turn?" asked Harmon. Savi shook her head and accelerated the crawler forward. Later, Demon thought that the sound of the machine hitting so many Voyniks at such high speed had been somewhat like a hailstorm he had heard on a metal roof in Ulaanbaat many years ago. But this was very large hail. The crawler reached the former shoreline. Savi cried, "Hang on!" And the machine was airborne for 10 seconds as it jumped the drop between shore and former sea. Then the 6 huge wheels hit the ground. The struts absorbed most of the shock and stabilized them. And they drove straight ahead down into the basin, headlights and searchlights still stabbing white cones out of the darkness. Demon looked back and saw the surviving Voyniks, silhouetted by the distant blue beam lining the shoreline behind them. "They won't follow?" he asked. "Into the basin?" said Savi. "Never." She slowed the crawler to a more reasonable speed, but before she slipped on her glasses and shut off the lights, Demon saw that they were following a smooth red clay road through verdant fields of crops. There were black metal crosses rising above the level of the wheat and corn and sunflowers and flax out there in the dark. And impaled on each cross was what looked to be a pale, writhing, naked human body. 34. The Coast of Ilium, Indiana. Achilles raged, roared, and tore at the tent wall where the goddess Athena had disappeared, dragging the body of Patroclus. Then the man-killer went mad. His guards rushed in. Still naked, Achilles lifted the first man and threw him at the head of the second guard. The third guard heard a roar and found himself also flying through the air, tearing through the canvas wall of the tent. The fourth threw down his spear and ran to wake the Myrmidons to let them know that their lord and captain had been possessed by a demon spirit. Achilles gathered up his breechcloth, his tunic, his breastplate, his shield, his polished bronze greaves, his sandals, and his spear, wrapped them in a sheet, and taking up his sword, cut his way through 3 canvas walls of tent. Outside, he shoved over the large tripod left burning in the center of his camp and ran past the darkened tents toward the dark sea and away from all the encampments of men toward his mother, the goddess Thetis. The waves crashed into shore, only the whites of each curl visible in the darkness here away from the fires. Achilles paced back and forth on the wet sand. He was still naked, his armor and his weapons scattered on the beach. While he paced, he pulled at his long hair and moaned aloud, occasionally crying out his mother's name in anguish. And Thetis, daughter of the sea god Nereus, the old man of the sea, answered Achilles' call, appearing from the salt green depths, rising up from the rolling surf like a mist, but then solidifying into the tall form of the noble goddess. Achilles ran to her like an injured child and fell to one knee in the wet sand. Thetis cradled his head against her wet breast while he sobbed. "My child, why the weeping? What sorrow has hurt your heart?" Achilles groaned. "You know, you must know, mother. Don't make me tell it all again." "I was with my father in the salt green depths," murmured Thetis, stroking Achilles' golden hair. Since mortal and gods were both sleeping so late, I did not see what transpired. Share it all, my son. And Achilles did, sobbing with grief, choking with anger. He told of the appearance of Pallas Athena, of her insults and taunts. He described the apparent murder of his friend Patroclus. "She took away his body, mother," cried Achilles. He was beyond comfort. "She took away his body so that I can't even perform the proper funeral rites for him." Thetis patted his shoulder and burst into tears herself. "Oh, my son, my sorrow, your birth was bitterness. All I bore was doom. Why did I raise you up if it is Zeus's will to throw you down?" Achilles raised his tear-streaked face. "So it is Zeus's will. It was Pallas Athena who just killed Patroclus, not some false image of the goddess." "It was Zeus's will," wept his mother. "And although I did not see it, I know it was goddess Athena herself who taunted you and killed your friend this night. Oh, the pity that you were doomed not only to a short life, Achilles, my son, but to one so filled with heartbreak." Achilles pulled away and stood. "Why did the immortal gods insult me so, mother? Why would Athena, who has championed the Argive cause, and especially my own for so many years, abandon me now?" "The gods are fickle," said Thetis, water still running from her long hair down to her breasts. "Perhaps you've noticed." Achilles paced back and forth in front of her, repeatedly balling his hands into fists and unballing them into splayed fingers as he stabbed at the air. "It makes no sense to bring me so far to help me in my conquest so frequently, only for Athena and her divine father to insult me so now. They're ashamed of you, Achilles." The man-killer stopped in his tracks and turned a pale, frozen face her way. He looked as if he had been slapped hard. "Ashamed of me? Ashamed of fleet-footed Achilles, son of Peleus and the goddess Thetis? Ashamed of the grandson of Aeacus?" "Yes," said his mother. "Zeus and the lesser gods, including Athena, have always had contempt for mortal men, even you heroes. From their vantage point on Olympus, you are all less than insects. Your lives are nasty, brutish, and short, and your very existences are justified only because you amuse them by your deaths. So by sulking in your tent while the fate of the war is sealed, you've irritated the third-born daughter of Zeus and Lord Godfather Zeus himself." "They killed Patroclus," roared Achilles, stepping back from the goddess, his bare feet leaving footprints in the wet sand, footprints that were washed away on the next roll of the surf. "They think you are too much of a coward to avenge his death," said Thetis. "They leave his corpse for the crows and vultures on the heights of Olympus." Achilles moaned and fell to his knees. He pulled great fistfuls of wet sand from the beach and smashed them to his bare chest. "Mother, why are you telling me this now? If you knew of the gods' contempt for me, why haven't you told me before? Always you taught me to serve and revere Zeus, to obey the goddess Athena." "I always hoped the other gods would grant mercy on our mortal children," said Thetis. "But Lord Zeus's cold heart and Athena's warrior ways have won the day. The race of men is of no interest to them any longer, not even for sport. Nor are we few immortals who argue your case safe from Zeus's wrath." Achilles stood and took 3 steps closer to his mother. "Mother, you're an immortal. Zeus cannot harm thee." Thetis laughed without humor. "The father can kill anything and anyone he wishes, my son. Even an immortal. Worse than that, he can banish us to the murk of Tartarus, throw us down into that hellish pit the way he did his own father, Cronos, and his weeping mother, Rhea." "So you're in danger," Achilles said numbly. He teetered like a man who has drunk too much or like a sailor on the pitching deck of a small ship at sea in storm. "I am doomed," said Thetis. "And so are you, my child, unless you do the one thing that no mortal, not even the brazen Heracles, has attempted before." "What, mother?" Achilles' face in the starlight was undergoing disturbing transformations as his emotions ran from despair to fury to something beyond fury. "Bring down the gods," whispered Thetis. The words were barely audible above the crashing surf. Achilles stepped even closer, his head bent as if not believing. "Bring down the gods," she whispered again. "Storm Olympus. Kill Athena. Depose Zeus." Achilles staggered back. "Can this be possible?" Not if you act alone, said Thetis. White waves curled around her feet. But if you bring your warring Argives and Achaeans with you. Agamemnon and his brother rule the Achaeans and the Argives and their allies this night, interrupted Achilles. He looked back at the fires burning along the miles of beach and then turned his head to look at the far more numerous Trojan watchfires burning just beyond the defensive trench. And the Argives and the Achaeans are on the verge of rout this night, Mother. The black ships may burn by sunrise. May burn, said Thetis. This day's victories to the Trojans are simply another sign of Zeus's whim. But the Argives and Achaeans will follow you to victory, even against the gods, Achilles. Just this night, Agamemnon said to Odysseus and Nestor, and the others gathered in his camp at midnight, that he was the better man, wiser and stronger and more bold than Achilles. Show him otherwise, my son. Show all of them otherwise. Achilles turned his back on her. He was looking toward distant Ilium, where torches burned bright on the high walls. I cannot fight the gods and the Trojans at the same time. Thetis touched his shoulder until he turned. You're right, my child. Achilles, swift runner. You must end this senseless war with Troy begun over Menelaus, bitch of a wife. Who cares where mortal Helen sleeps, or if the Atreidae, Menelaus, and his arrogant brother Agamemnon are cuckolded or not? End the war. Make peace with Hector. He too has reason to hate the gods this night. Achilles looked quizzically at Thetis, but she did not explain. He looked back at the torches and the distant city. Would that I could see Olympus tonight so that I could kill Athena, throw down Zeus, and reclaim Patroclus' body for his rights. His voice was soft, but terrible in its mad resolve. I will send a man to show you the way, said Thetis. He wheeled on her again. When? Tomorrow, after you have spoken with Hector, made common bond with the fighting Trojans, and taken kingship of the Argives and Achaeans from posturing Agamemnon. Achilles blinked at the breathtaking audacity of this. How shall I find Hector without him killing me or me killing him? I will send you a man to show you the way for that as well, said Thetis. She stepped back. The pre-dawn surf crashed against the backs of her legs. Mother, stay! I go to Father Zeus's halls to find my fate now, whispered his mother. Voice all but lost in the sibilant surf. I will argue your case a final time, my son, but I fear failure and banishment will be my lot. Be bold, Achilles, be brave. Your fate has been set but not sealed. You still have the choice of death and glory or long life, but also life and glory, and such glory, Achilles. No mortal man ever dreamt of such glory. Avenge Patroclus, mother. The gods can die, my child, the gods can die. Her form wavered, shifted, became a mist, and disappeared. Achilles stood staring out to sea for long minutes, stood staring until the cold light of dawn began creeping from the east, and then he turned, donned his clothing and his sandals and his armor and his greaves, hefted his great shield, slid his sword into its sheath on his sword belt, took up his spear and began walking toward Agamemnon's camp. After this performance, I collapse. All through the dialogue, my morphing bracelet was beeping in my ear with its AI voice. 10 minutes of power left before shutdown, 6 minutes of power left before, and so forth. The morphing gear is almost out of charge, and I have no idea how to recharge it. I have just under 3 minutes of morphing time left, but I'll need that to visit Hector's family. You can't kidnap a child. Comes the ever smaller voice that is all that's left of my conscience. I have to, comes the only response I have. I have to. I'm in this now, I've thought it through. Patroclus was the secret to Achilles. Scamandrius and Andromache, Hector's son and wife, are the secret to turning Hector. The only way. In for a penny, in for a pound. Earlier, when I'd QT'd into existence on the sunny afternoon hill of what I still hoped to be Indiana, the unconscious Patroclus in my arms, there had been no sign of Nightenhalser. I dropped Patroclus quickly into the grass. I'm not homophobic, but dragging a naked man makes me feel odd. And I'd called toward the river and forest for Keith Nightenhalser, but no response. Perhaps the ancient Native Americans had scalped him by now or adopted him into their tribe. or perhaps he was just across the river and into the woods gathering nuts and berries. Patroclus groaned and stirred. What are the ethics of leaving a groggy, naked man as a stranger in a strange land like this? Would a bear kill him? Not likely. It was more likely that Patroclus would find and kill poor Nightenhelser, although the Greek was naked and unarmed, and Keith was still decked out in impact armor, taser baton, and prop sword. Yes, I'd put my money on Patroclus. What are the ethics of leaving a pissed-off Patroclus in the same berry-gathering acre of land where I'd left a peace-loving academic? I didn't have time to worry about it. I'd checked the morphing bracelet's power, found it waning, and QT'd back to the coast of Ilium. I'd learned a little about becoming a goddess from the Athena experience, and Thetis wouldn't require as much energy to morph into as had Zeus's daughter. With a bit of luck, I thought the morphing gear would work long enough to allow me my scene with Achilles and leave a bit left over for Hector's family. And it did. And I do have a bit left over. I can morph a final time. Hector's family. What have I become? A man on the run, I think, as I pull the Hades helmet over my head and walk along the sand, a desperate man. Will the QT medallion run out of power soon as well? Does the taser hold another charge if I need it in Ilium? I'll find out soon. Wouldn't it be ironic if I succeeded in turning both Achilles and Hector to my cause, but then didn't have the quantum teleportation power to get them or me to Olympus? I'll worry about that later. I'll worry about all this crap later. Right now, I have a 4 a.m. appointment with Hector's wife and baby boy. 35. 12,000 meters above the Tharsis Plateau. What does Proust have to say about balloons?
Not much, said Orfu of Io. He wasn't big on traveling in general. What does Shakespeare say about balloons?
Monmouth let that go. I wish you could see this.
I wish I could see it too, said Orfu. Describe everything to me.
Monmouth looked up. We're high enough here that the sky overhead is almost black, fading to dark blue, then to a lighter blue by the horizon, which is definitely curved. I can see the band of haze of atmosphere in both directions. Beneath us, it's still cloudy. The early morning light makes the clouds glow gold and pink. Behind us, the cloud cover is broken, and I can see the blue water and red cliffs of Valles Marineris stretching back to the eastern horizon. To the west, the direction we're traveling, the clouds cover most of the Tharsis Plateau. They seem to be hugging the ground along the rising terrain, but the three closer volcanoes are poking up through the gold clouds. Arcia Mons is furthest to the left, then Pavonis Mons, then Ascrius Mons farther over to the right, to the north. They're all a bright white snow and ice gleaming in the morning light.
Can you see Olympus yet?
Asked Orfu. Oh, yes. Even though it's the farthest away, Olympus Mons is the tallest thing in sight, rising over the western curve of the planet. It's between Pavonis and Ascrius, but obviously further away. It's also white with ice and snowfields, but the summit is free of snow and red in the sunrise.
Can you see Noctis Labyrinthus, where we left the Zex?
Monmouth leaned over the edge of the gondola he'd built and looked below and behind them. No, still cloud cover there. But when we were rising toward the overcast, I could see all of the quarry, the docks, and the whole tumble of Noctis. Beyond the seaport and quarry there, the jumble of canyons and cliff collapses runs hundreds of kilometers west and scores of clicks north and south. It had been raining the last days of their Felucca voyage, raining when they put into the crowded docks at the LGM quarry site in Noctis Labyrinthus, and raining harder when Monmouth had finally assembled the jury-rigged gondola, inflated the balloon from its own tanks, and set out above what could only be called a city of the Little Green Men. One of the LGM, or Zex, as they called themselves, had obviously offered his heart for communication, but Monmouth had shaken his head no. Perhaps they didn't die as individuals, as Orfu argued, but the sensation of using up another Little Green Man was more than Monmouth could handle. Instead, the gathered Zex had immediately understood what Monmouth was doing with his homemade gondola, and they'd moved quickly to help connect tether cables, spread the fabric of the single-chamber high-pressure balloon while it slowly inflated, and secure ground cables against the wind, all the while working as efficiently as a highly trained ground crew.
"What does the balloon look like?" asked Orfu.
The deep space Moravec was tethered in the center of the enlarged gondola, strapped down by many meters of line and set into a frame Monmut had hammered together. Nearby, shielded and secured, were the transmitter and the smaller device.
"It's like a giant pumpkin above us," said Monmut.
Orfu rumbled over the tight beam.
"Have you ever seen a pumpkin in real life?"
"Of course not. But we've both seen images. The balloon's an orange ovoid, wider than it is tall, about 65 meters across and about 50 meters tall. It has vertical ridges like a pumpkin, and it's orange."
"I thought it was sheathed in stealth material," said Orfu, sounding surprised.
"It is. Orange stealth material. I guess our Moravec designers didn't consider the fact that the people we'd be sneaking up on might have eyes as well as radar."
This time Orfu's rumble sounded like deep thunder.
"Typical," said the Ionian. "Typical."
"Our cluster of bucky-carbon cables is rigged from the bottom of the balloon," said Monmut. "Our gondola's hanging about 40 meters beneath the fabric."
"Securely, I hope," said Orfu.
"As secure as I could make it, although maybe I forgot to tie a couple of knots."
Orfu rumbled again and went silent. Monmut watched the view for a while.
When Orfu made contact again, it was night. The stars burned coldly, but Monmut was still aware of more atmospheric twinkle than he'd ever seen in his life. The moon, Phobos, was hurtling low across the sky, and Deimos had just risen. The clouds and volcanoes reflected the starlight. To the north, the ocean glimmered.
"Are we there yet?"
asked Orfu. "Not quite. Another day, day and a half."
"Is the wind still blowing us in the right direction?"
"More or less."
"Define less, old friend."
"We're heading north-northwest. We may miss Olympus Mons by a shade."
"That takes a certain skill," said Orfu. "To miss a volcano the size of France."
"It's a balloon," said Monmut. "I'm sure that Koros III planned to launch it from near the base of the volcano, not from 1,200 kilometers away."
"Wait," said Orfu. "I seem to remember a little detail about the Tethys Sea being just north of Olympus."
Monmut sighed. "That's why I built this new gondola in the shape of an open boat."
"You never mentioned that while you were building it."
"It didn't seem relevant then." They floated along in silence for a while. They were approaching the Tharsis volcanoes, and Monmut thought they might pass the northernmost, Ascrius, by midday tomorrow. If the wind kept shifting, they'd miss the slopes completely, passing 10 or 20 kilometers to the north of it. Monmut didn't even have to change his vision into light enhancement mode to marvel at the beauty of the moon's light and the starlight on the icy upper regions of all four volcanoes.
"I've been thinking about this Prospero Caliban thing," Orfu said suddenly,
making Monmut jump slightly. He'd been lost in thought.
"Yes?" "I presume you're thinking along the same lines that I've been, that these statues of Prospero and the LGM's knowledge of the Tempest are the result of some human or post-human dictator's interest in Shakespeare."
"We don't even know for sure that the stone heads are supposed to be Prospero," said Monmut.
"Of course not. But the LGM suggested they were, and I don't think Gazek's ever lied to us. Perhaps they can't lie, not when communicating with you through molecular nano-data packages the way they were."
Monmut said nothing, but that had been his impression as well.
"Somehow," continued Orfu, "those thousands of stone heads circling the North Ocean..."
"And the flooded Hellas Basin in the south," said Monmut, remembering the orbital images.
"Yeah. Somehow those thousands of stone heads have something to do with Shakespeare's characters."
Monmut nodded at this, knowing that blind Orfu would take his silence as a nod.
"What if the dictator is actually Prospero?" said Orfu. "And not a human or post-human at all."
"I don't understand." Monmut was confused. He checked the flow of oxygen from the tanks stowed near the device. Both he and Orfu were securely jacked in and getting full flow. What do you mean? What if the dictator was actually Prospero? You mean some post-human was playing the role of the old magician and forgot they were role-playing?
No, said Orfu. I mean, what if it's Prospero?
Manmut felt a stab of alarm. Orfu had been battered and blinded, zapped by huge quantities of ionizing radiation, and buffeted in the spaceship's fall into the northern sea. Perhaps his reason was going.
No, I'm not crazy, said Orfu, sounding disgusted. Listen to what I'm saying.
Prospero is a literary character, we know about him only because of the memory banks about human culture and history that were sent along with the early Moravecs 2 millennia ago.
Yes, said Orfu. Prospero is a fictional construct and the Greek gods are myths. And that their presence here is just because they're humans, or post-humans in disguise. But what if they aren't? What if they're really Prospero, really Greek gods?
Manmut felt true alarm now. He had looked straight on at the terror of continuing on this mission alone should Orfu die, but he'd never considered the worse alternative of having a blinded, crippled, insane Orfu of Io as a companion on this last stage of the mission. Could he bring himself to leave Orfu behind when they landed? How could the gods, or whatever these people in togas and flying chariots are, not be myths or post-humans lost in role-playing? Asked Monmouth. Are you suggesting they're space aliens? Ancient Martians who somehow weren't noticed during the Lost Age exploration of this planet? What?
I'm saying, what if the Greek gods are Greek gods? Orfu said softly. What if Prospero is Prospero? Caliban? Caliban. Should we meet him, which I hope we don't.
Uh-huh, said Monmouth. Interesting theory.
God damn it, don't patronize me, snapped Orfu. Do you know anything about quantum teleportation?
Just the theory behind it, said Monmouth, and the fact that this world is riddled with active quantum activity.
Holes, said Orfu.
What?
They're like wormholes. When quantum shift events are maintained like this, even for a few nanoseconds, you get a standing wormhole singularity effect. You know what a singularity is, right?
Yes, said Monmouth, irritated now at the way his friend was talking to him. I know the definitions of wormholes, singularities, black holes, and quantum teleportation, and I know how all those conditions, except the last one, warp space-time. But what the hell does that have to do with gods in togas and flying chariots? These are post-humans we're dealing with on Mars, possibly crazy post-humans, self-evolved beyond sanity, but post-humans.
You may be right, said Orfu. But let's look at another alternative.
Which is what? That fictional characters have suddenly come to life?
Do you know why Moravec engineers gave up on developing quantum teleportation as a way to travel to the stars? Said Orfu.
It's not stable, said Monmut. There's evidence of some accident on Earth 1,500 or so years ago. The humans or post-humans were fooling around with quantum wormholes, and it didn't work, and backfired on them somehow.
A lot of Moravec observers think that it backfired precisely because it did work, said Orfu.
I don't understand.
Quantum teleportation is an old technology, said the Ionian. The old-style humans were experimenting with it way back in the 20th or 21st century, before the posts even evolved themselves out of the human species, before everything went to shit on Earth.
So?
So the essence of quantum teleportation was that you couldn't send large objects, nothing much bigger than a photon, and not even that, really, just the complete quantum state of that photon.
What's the difference between the complete quantum state of something or somebody and that thing or person? Asked Monmouth.
Nothing, said Orfu. That's the sweet part. Quantum teleport a photon or a Percheron stallion, and you get a complete duplicate of the thing on the other end. So complete a duplicate that, to all intents and purposes, it is the photon.
Or Percheron, said Monmouth. He'd always enjoyed looking at images of horses. As far as the Moraveks knew, real horses had been extinct on Earth for millennia.
But even if you teleport a photon from one place to another, continued Orfu, the rules of quantum physics demand that the particle teleported can bring no information with it. Not even information about its own quantum state.
Sort of useless, then, isn't it? Said Monmouth. Phobos had finished its fast hurtle across the Martian night sky and sat behind the distant curve of the world. Deimos moved at a more stately pace.
That's what the humans back in the 20th or 21st century thought, said Orfu. But then the post-humans began playing with quantum teleportation, first on Earth, and then in their orbital cities or whatever those objects in near-Earth orbit are.
And they had more success, said Monmouth. But we know that something went wrong about 1,400 years ago, right about the time the Earth was showing all that quantum activity.
Something went wrong, agreed Orfu. But it wasn't a failure of the quantum teleportation. The post-humans, or their thinking machines, developed a line of quantum transport based on entangled particles.
Spooky action at a distance, said Monmouth. He'd never been very interested in nuclear physics or astrophysics or particle physics. Hell, in physics of any form. But he'd always enjoyed Einstein's damning phrase attacking quantum mechanics. Einstein had owned a wicked tongue when it came to shooting down colleagues or theories he didn't like.
Yes, said Orfu. The Ionian obviously didn't enjoy getting interrupted. Well, spooky action at a distance works on a quantum level, and the post-humans began sending larger and larger objects through quantum portals.
Percheron stallions? Said Monmouth. He didn't especially like being lectured at.
No record of that, but the horses on Earth seem to have gone somewhere, so why not? Look, Monmouth, I'm very serious here. I've been thinking about this since we left Jupiter space. Can I finish without the sarcasm?
Monmouth metaphorically blinked. Orfu did not sound so insane any longer, but he did sound serious and hurt. All right, said Monmouth. I apologize. Go ahead.
We know that the post-humans accelerated their quantum research, fooling around, really, about the time we Moraveks abandoned it about 1,400 Earth years ago. They were punching holes in space-time left and right.
Excuse me, said Monmouth, interrupting as softly as he could. I thought only black holes or wormholes or naked singularities could do that.
And quantum tunnels left activated, said Orfu.
But I thought quantum teleportation was instantaneous, said Monmouth. He was trying hard to understand now that it had to be instantaneous.
It does. With entanglement pairs, particles or complex structures shifting the quantum state of one member of the quantum twin set instantly changes the quantum state of its partner.
Then how can there be tunnels activated if the tunneling is instantaneous? Said Monmouth.
Trust me on this, said Orfu. When you're teleporting something large, say a small slice of cheese, just the amount of random quantum data being transmitted shoots the shit out of space-time.
How much raw quantum data would be in, say, a 3-gram slice of cheese?
10^24 power bits, answered Orfu without hesitation.
And how much in a human being?
Not counting the person's memory, but just his or her atoms, said Orfu. 10^28 power kilobytes of data.
Well, that's just 4 more zeros than a slice of cheese, said Monmouth.
Mother of mercy, whined Orfu. We're talking orders of magnitude here, which means...
I know what it means, said Monmouth. I was just being silly again. Go on.
So about 1,400 years ago on Earth, the post-humans... It had to be the post-human, since our probes at the time were sure that there were just 1,000 or so old-style humans left, like almost extinct species animals being kept around in a zoo. The post-humans began quantum teleporting people and machines and other objects.
Where? Said Monmouth. I mean, where did they send them? Mars? Other star systems?
No, you need a receiver as well as a transmitter with quantum teleportation, said the Ionian. They just sent them from somewhere on the Earth to somewhere else on the Earth, or in their orbital cities, but they had a big surprise when the objects materialized.
Does this have something to do with a fly? Asked Monmouth.
His secret vice was old movies from the 20th century to the end of the Lost Age.
A fly? Said Orfu. No, why?
Never mind. What was the big surprise they got when they teleported these things?
First, that the quantum teleportation worked, said Orfu. But more important, that when the person or animal or thing came through, it carried information with it. Information about its own quantum state. Information about everything it shouldn't have information about, including memory for the human beings.
I thought you said the rules of quantum mechanics forbid that.
They do, said Orfu.
Magic again? Asked Monmouth, feeling the tug of alarm at the direction Orfu was headed. Are we talking Prospero and Greek gods here?
Yes, but not in the way you sarcastically mean, said Orfu of Isle. Our scientists at the time thought that the post-humans were actually exchanging tangled pairs with identical objects, or persons, in another universe.
Another universe, Monmouth repeated dully, as in parallel universes?
Not quite, said Orfu. Not like the old idea of an infinite or near-infinite number of parallel universes. Just a few. A very finite number of quantum phase-shifted universes coexisting with or near our own.
Monmouth had no idea what his friend was talking about, but he said nothing.
Not only coexisting quantum universes, continued the deep space Moravec, but created universes.
Created? Repeated Monmouth, as in God?
No, said Orfu, as in through acts of genius, by geniuses.
I don't understand. Thymos had set. The Martian volcanoes were visible now in starlight, masses of clouds creeping up their long slopes like pale, gray amoebae. Monmouth checked his internal chronometer, 1 hour until Martian sunrise. He was cold.
You know what human researchers found when they were studying the human mind millennia ago, said Orfu. Back before the post-humans were even a factor. Our own Moravec minds are built the same way, although we use artificial as well as organic brain matter.
Monmouth tried to remember. The human scientists were using quantum computers way back in the 21st century, he said, to analyze biochemical cascades in human synapses. They discovered that the human mind, not the brain, but the mind, wasn't like a computer. It wasn't like a chemical memory machine, but was exactly like
a quantum state-standing wavefront, said Orfu. Human consciousness exists primarily as a quantum state waveform, just like the rest of the universe.
And you're saying that consciousness itself created these other universes? Monmouth followed the logic, if it could be called that, but he was shocked by the absurd implications.
Not just consciousness, said Orfu. Exceptional types of consciousness that are like naked singularities in that they can bend space-time, affect the organization of space-time, and collapse probability waves into discrete alternatives. I'm talking Shakespeare here, Proust, Homer.
But that's so, stammered Monmouth.
Solipsistic?
Stupid, said Monmouth.
They floated along in silence for several minutes. Monmouth assumed that he might have hurt his friend's feelings, but that wasn't important right now. After a while, he said over the tight beam, "So, are you expecting to find the ghosts of the real Greek gods when we get to Olympus Mons?"
"Not ghosts," said Orfu. "But you saw the quantum readings. Whoever these people are on Olympus, they've punched quantum holes all around this world, all centered on or near Olympus. They're going somewhere, coming from somewhere else. The quantum reality of this area is so unstable it may actually implode and take a chunk of our solar system with it."
"Do you think that's what the device is built to do?" asked Monmouth. "Implode the quantum fields here before they reach some critical mass?"
"I don't know," said Orfu. "Perhaps.
And do you think that's what screwed up the Earth and sent the post-humans to their orbital cities 1,400 years ago there? Some quantum failure?
No, said Orfu. I think that whatever happened on Earth was a result of quantum teleportation success, not failure.
What do you mean? For a brief second, Monmouth was not sure he wanted to hear the answer.
I think they punched quantum tunnels into one or more of these alternate realities, said Orfu. And they let something in.
They floated along in silence until sunrise. The sun touched the top of the balloon first, painting the orange fabric in unreal light and causing each bucky cable to gleam. Then it reached the three Tharsis volcanoes glinting on ice, moving goldly down the east side of each of the three volcanoes like so much slow magma. Then the sun bathed the breaking clouds in pink and gold and illuminated the Valles Marineris inland sea all the way to the eastern horizon like a lapis crack in the world. Olympus Mons caught the sunlight a minute later, and Monmouth watched as the great peak seemed to rise above the western horizon like some advancing galleon with sails of gold and red. Then the sun glinted on something closer and higher.
Orfu,
sent Monmouth. We have company.
One of the chariots, still too far away to tell.
Even with vision magnification, it's lost in the sunrise glare.
Anything we can do if it is the chariot people? Have you found any weapons without telling me?
All we have to throw at them is harsh language, said Monmouth, still watching the gleaming speck. It was moving very fast and would be on them soon. Unless you want me to trigger the device.
It might be a bit early for that, said Orfu.
It seems odd that Koros III came on this mission without weapons.
We don't know what he would have brought along from the command pod, said Orfu. But that reminds me of something I've been thinking about.
What's that?
You remember we were discussing Koros' secret mission to the asteroid belt a few years ago?
Yes. The sun was still blazing from the advancing aircraft, but Monmouth could see that it was a chariot now, its holographic horses in full gallop.
What if it wasn't a spy mission? Said Orfo.
What do you mean?
I mean, the Rockmoraveks have one thing we five moons types never bothered to evolve.
Aggression, said Monmouth. Bellicosity?
Exactly. What if Koros III was sent not as a spy, but as a...
Excuse me, interrupted Monmouth, but our guest is here. One large humanoid in a chariot. Sonic booms crashed around Monmouth, rippling the fabric of the huge balloon above. The chariot continued to decelerate. It circled the balloon once from a distance of 100 meters.
The same man who greeted us in orbit? Asked Orfu.
His voice was perfectly calm. Monmouth looked at the helpless shell lashed to the deck without so much as an eye to watch what was going on. No, he said, that Greek god had a gray beard. This one is younger and clean-shaven. He looks to be about 3 meters tall. Monmouth held up his hand, palm outward, in the ancient sign for greeting, showing no weapon. I think he... The chariot wheeled closer. The man at the reins held out his right hand, fist closed, and swept the fist from right to left. The balloon exploded above them, helium venting as the fabric flamed. Monmouth grabbed the wooden railing of the gondola to keep from being thrown out as the twisting mass of flaming fabric, bucky carbon cable, and boat-shaped gondola plunged toward the Tharsis Plateau, 13 kilometers below. The little Moravec was in negative G, feet above his head, connected to the gondola only by his fierce grip on the railing as the platform began to tumble in freefall. The chariot with its ghost-like horses flew right at and through the flaming balloon fabric above. The man, God, reached out and grabbed the black bucky cable in one huge fist. Impossibly, absurdly, instead of ripping his arm out of its socket, the gondola jerked to a stop as the man held several tons in one hand. He whipped the horses with the reins, using his other hand. Trailing the pitching gondola and its contents 40 meters below and behind it, the chariot turned and flew west toward Olympus Mons. 36. The Mediterranean Basin. Savi drove another hour or so down the red clay road, steering the crawler deeper into the fields and folds of the Mediterranean Basin. It was dark and raining hard now, with lightning flashing and thunder vibrating the glass sphere of the passenger shell. Demon pointed out the crosses with their humanoid shapes in one of the bright flashes. What are those, people?
Not people, said Savi. Karabani.
Before she could explain, Demon said, We have to stop. Savi did so, turning on the headlights and overhead lights and removing her night vision glasses. What's wrong? Evidently, she could see the distress on Demon's face. I'm starving, he said. I have 2 food bars in my pack. I'm dying of thirst, he said. I have a water bottle in the pack, and we can crack the shell and get some fresh cold rainwater. I have to go to the toilet, said Demon. Bad. Ah, well, said Savi. The crawler has a lot of nice amenities, but no onboard toilet. We could probably all use a rest stop. She touched 2 virtual buttons on the force field, quit keeping rain off the glass, and the slice in the side of the bubble slid open. The air was fresh and smelled of wet fields and crops. Outside, said Demon, not trying to hide his horror, in the open? In the cornfield, said Savi, more privacy there. She reached into her pack and took out a roll of tissues, handing Demon some. He stared at the tissues with shock. I can use a rest stop, said Harmon, accepting some of the flimsy tissues from her. Come on, Demon. Men to the right of the crawler, ladies to the left. He stepped out through the slice and clambered down the strut ladder. Demon followed, still holding the tissues like a talisman, and the old woman clambered down behind him with more grace than he'd shown. I'll have to go to the right as well, said Savi. Different row of corn, perhaps, but not too far away. Why? Began Demon, but then he saw the black gun in her hand. Oh. She tucked the weapon in her belt, and the 3 walked off the road across a low ditch, across a muddy stretch of field, and into the high corn. The rain was falling heavily now. We'll be soaked, Demon said. I didn't bring my self-drying clothes. Savi looked up at the sky as lightning ripped from cloud to cloud and the thunder echoed down the broad basin. I have both your thermskins in the pack. We get back in the crawler, you can wear those while the other clothes dry. Anything else in that magical pack that you want to tell us about? Asked Harmon. Savi shook her head. A few food bars, flechette clips, a flashlight, and some maps I drew myself. All of our thermskins, water bottle, an extra sweater I carry around, that's about it. As eager as Demon was to get into the privacy of the cornfield, he paused at the edge of it to peer around. Is it safe out here? He asked. Savi shrugged. No Voynix. What about those? What did you call them? Kalabani, said Savi. Don't worry about them tonight. He nodded and stepped into the first row of corn. The stalks rose 2 or 3 feet higher than his head. Rain pattered heavily on the broad leaves. He stepped back out. It's really dark in there. Harmon had disappeared into the corn already, and Savi was walking the other direction, but she stopped, turned, walked back, and handed Demon the flashlight. There's enough lightning for me to see. Demon shouldered his way through the high stalks for 8 or 10 rows, trying to get far enough away from the edge of the field to be completely invisible. Then he walked another 8 or 9 rows to be safe. He found a row perhaps a bit less muddy than the other rows, looked around, set the flashlight against a cornstalk so the beam cut upward only, reminding him of the blue beam in Jerusalem, and then he dropped his trousers, squatted, and dug a shallow hole with his hands. What did Savi call this, he thought? Camping? When he was finished, a terrific relief despite the barbarous circumstances, he did the best he could with the wet and soggy tissues in his hand, found it not enough, tossed the tissues into the muddy hole, and then felt the bulge in his tunic pocket. He pulled out the 30 inches of folded material that he always carried, his Turin cloth. In the light reflecting from the flashlight illuminated cornstalks above him, he studied the fine linen and the beautiful microcircuit imprinted embroidery that brought the Turin drama directly to one's brain. Watching the Trojans battle the Achaeans had been an occasional habit of his for years, but after meeting the real Odysseus, if the bearded old man was the real Odysseus, which didn't seem at all likely, Demon didn't retain much interest in the Turin drama. Odysseus
had not only slept with one of the girls Demon had planned to seduce, Hannah, but he'd gone home to Artis Hall with Demon's primary target of opportunity, Ada. Still, he held the beautiful linen cloth in his hand as if weighing it. To hell with it. Demon used it, taking an unexpected pleasure in vicariously treating the arrogant Odysseus this way. Tossed it in the hole, kicked mud over the hole, hitched up his trousers and set his tunic straight, tried to wash his hands against the rain-slick cornstalks, and then picked up his flashlight and walked the 2 dozen or so rows out of the field. But there was no end to the field. After 35 rows or so, he was sure he had gone the wrong direction. He spun around trying to ascertain the correct direction. All he had to do was follow his muddy footprints back in the opposite direction, but the spinning had disoriented him so that he couldn't tell which direction he'd been heading. And the footprints were nowhere to be found. The lightning was more intense now, the rain coming down harder. "Help!" shouted Demon. He waited a second, heard no reply, and shouted again, "Help! I'm lost in here!" Thunder drowned out both of his cries. He turned again, then again, decided that this had to be the right direction back, and began running through the high corn, bending stalks aside, battering at them with the small flashlight. He forgot to count the rows, but must have gone 40 or 50 wet rows before stopping again. "Help! I'm in here!" This time no thunder drowned his shouting, but there was still no reply, no noise, except for the hard patter of rain on the corn stalks and the squelch of his soggy city shoes. He began moving up a row, watching to both sides for light or movement, not thinking of how this movement would just get him further away from the other two. After several minutes, he had to pause for breath. "Help!" Lightning struck less than a mile away, and the thunder moved across the tall corn like a shockwave. Demon blinked away the after images of the flash and noticed that the corn seemed less thick up the row and to his right. It had to be the edge of the field. He ran the last 15 rows or so and burst into the opening. It was not the edge of the field where he'd entered, but a clearing, perhaps 20 feet wide and 30 feet deep. In the center of the clearing, rising 6 or 8 feet taller than the corn, was a large metal cross. Demon ran the beam of the flashlight from the base of the cross up to the top of it. The figure was not on the cross, but rather nestled in the hollowed-out metal form. Its naked torso wedged into the upright column, its bare arms extended in the cross members. The flashlight beam jiggled in the downpour as Demon stared. It was not a man, at least like no man Demon had ever seen. The man-thing was naked and slick, scaled and greenish, not fish green, but with the green Demon had always imagined as the color of corpses before the firmary ended such barbarities. The scales were small and numerous and gleamed in the flashlight. The thing was well-muscled, but the muscles were wrong. The arms too long, forearms too lanky, wrists too powerful, knuckles far too large, yellow claws instead of fingernails, thighs too powerful, feet three-toed and oddly splayed. It was a male. The penis and scrotum were obscenely visible and garishly pink beneath the washboard stomach and muscled abdomen. Again, somehow wrong, like a turtle or shark with almost human genitalia. But the thick upper torso, snake-like neck, and hairless head were the least human aspects of the creature. Rain ran off the muscles and scales and banded ligaments, dripping across the rough black metal of the cross. The eyes were sunken under brows at once ape-like and fish-like, and the face extruded out more snout or gill-like than nose. Under the snout, the thing's mouth hung slightly open, and Demon stared at the long yellow teeth, not human, not animal, more fish-like if fish were monsters, and a far too long bluish tongue that stirred even as Demon watched. He flicked the flashlight beam higher and almost screamed again. The man-thing's eyes had opened, oblong yellow cat's eyes, without a cat's cool connection to humanity, with tiny black slits in the center. The thing, what had Savi called it? The Kalabani, stirred in its cross niche, the hands opened from fists to extended fingers, long claws catching the light, and the legs and torso shifted as if the creature were waking and stretching. There were no restraints on it. There was nothing to keep it from leaping down at Demon this instant. Demon tried to run, but found that he couldn't turn his back on the thing. It stirred again, its right hand and most of its arm coming free from the cross niche. Its feet, Demon now saw, also held yellow claws at the end of the webbed toes. There was a crashing and roar behind Demon. More Calibani, already free from their crosses, he was sure. And Demon whirled to meet their charge, raising the flashlight like a club and losing the light from it. His feet slipped, or his legs weakened, and Demon went to his knees in the mud in the clearing. He felt like crying, but didn't think he did in the few seconds before the crawler burst from the row of corn, looming like a monstrous spider over Demon, and the cornfield, and the cross, and the unmoving Calibani. The crawler's eight headlights switched on, blinding him. He threw his forearm across his face, but he realized later, more to hide his tears than to protect his eyes from the light. Dressed in thermskins, the two men reclining on the cracked leather chairs and the old woman lying on the inner curve of the glass sphere. They ate their food bars, passed around the water bottle, and watched the storm in silence for a while. Demon had asked Savi to get away from the field and the cross and the creature, so she'd driven a mile or two up the red clay road before pulling to the side and shutting off everything but the crawler's force field and dim virtual panels. "What was that thing?" Demon said at last. "One of the Calibani," said Savi. She actually looked comfortable lying on the glass wall, backpack behind her head. "I know what you called them," snapped Demon. "What are they?" Savi sighed. "If I start explaining one thing, then I have to explain the rest. There's a lot you Eloi don't know. Almost everything, actually." "Why don't you start with explaining why you call us Eloi?" said Harmon. His voice was hard. "I guess it started as a form of insult," said Savi. Lightning flashed, illuminating the lines on her face, but the storm had moved on far enough that the thunder came late, from very far away. "Although, to be fair, I called my own people that before calling yours the word." "What does it mean?" demanded Harmon. "It's a term from a very old story in a very old book," said Savi, "about a man who travels through time to the far future and finds humankind evolved into two races, one gentle, lazy, purposeless, basking in the sun, the Eloi, and the other ugly, monstrous, productive, technological, but hiding in caves and darkness, the Morlocks. In the old book, the Morlocks provided food, shelter, and clothing for the Eloi until the gentle people had fattened up nicely, and then the Morlocks ate them." Lightning flashed across the fields again, but it was a pale, receding light. "Is that what our world is like?" asked Demon. "Us as the Eloi and the Calibani and Voynix as the Morlocks? Do they eat us?" "I wish it were that simple," said Savi. She laughed softly, but the noise held no humor. "What are the Calibani?" said Harmon. Instead of answering, the old woman said, "Demon, show Harmon one of your palm tricks." Demon hesitated. "Which one?" he said. "Proxnet or Farnet?" "We know where we are, darling," the old woman said sarcastically. "Show him Farnet." Demon scowled, but did so. He told Harmon to think of three blue squares in the center of three red circles, and suddenly a blue oval was floating over both of their palms. "Think of someone," Demon said, feeling strange. He'd never taught anyone anything before, if one didn't count sexual techniques. "Anyone," he added, "just visualize them." Harmon looked dubious but concentrated. An aerial representation of Ardis filled Harmon's oval, then a diagram of the layout of Ardis Hall. A stylized female figure was standing with a group of stylized men and women on the front porch of the manor. "Ada," said Demon. "You were thinking of Ada." "Incredible," said Harmon. He stared at the image for a moment. "I'm going to visualize Odysseus," he said. The image shifted, changed magnitude, searched, but came up with nothing. "Farnet doesn't have a lock on Odysseus, according to Savi," said Demon. "But go back to Ada. Look where she is." Harmon frowned, but focused. The stylized cartoon of Ada was in a field 100 yards or so behind Ardis Hall. There were scores of other human figures represented, seated in front and around a void. Ada joined the crowd. Demon looked at Harmon's palm image. I wonder what's going on there. If Odysseus is in that empty spot, it looks as if the old barbarian's addressing a crowd.
And Ada's listening to him or watching him perform, said Harmon.
He looked away from the palm oval. What does this have to do with my question, Savi? Who are the Calibani? Why are the Voynichs trying to kill us? What's going on?
A few centuries before the final facts, she said, folding her hands together, the post-humans got too clever by half. Their science was impressive. To all intents and purposes, they'd fled the Earth to their orbital rings during the terrible Rubicon epidemic. But they were still masters of the Earth. They thought they were masters of the universe. The posts had rigged the whole Earth with the limited form of energy data transmission and retrieval that you call faxing. And now they were experimenting, playing really, with time travel, quantum teleportation, and other dangerous things. A lot of their playing around was predicated on ancient sciences from as far back as the 19th century. Black hole physics, wormhole theory, quantum mechanics. But what they relied on most was the 20th century discovery that, at its heart, everything is information. Data. Consciousness. Matter. Energy. Everything is information.
I don't understand, said Harmon. He sounded angry.
Demon, you've shown Harmon the Farnet function. Why don't you show him the AllNet?
AllNet? Repeated Demon, alarm in his voice. You know, four blue triangles above three red circles above four green triangles.
No, said Demon. He thought off his own palm function. The blue glow winked out. Savi looked at Harmon.
If you want to begin to understand why we're here tonight, why the post-humans left Earth forever, and why the Calibani and Voynichs are around, visualize four blue triangles above three red circles above four green triangles. It gets easier with practice.
Harmon looked suspiciously at Demon, but then he closed his eyes and concentrated. Demon concentrated on not visualizing those shapes. He forced himself to remember Ada naked as a teenager, to remember the last time he had sex with a girl, to remember his mother scolding him.
My God! Cried Harmon.
Demon looked at the other man. Harmon had stood stumbling out of his chair and was whirling, moving his head in jerks, staring open-mouthed at everything.
What do you see? Savi asked softly. What do you hear?
God! God! Moaned Harmon.
I see. Jesus Christ! Everything, everything! Energy, the stars are singing, the corn in the fields is speaking to each other, to the earth. I see the crawler is full of little microbes, repairing it, cooling it. I see, my God, my hand.
Harmon was studying his hand with a look of total horror and revelation.
Enough for the first time, said Savi. Think the word off.
Not yet, gasped Harmon. He stumbled against the glass wall of the passenger sphere and clawed at it weakly as if trying to get out. It's so...
so beautiful, I can almost think off, roared Savi.
Harmon blinked, fell against the wall, and turned a pale, staring face in their direction.
What was that? He said. I saw everything, heard everything.
And understood nothing, said Savi, but neither do I when I'm on AllNet. Perhaps even the post-humans didn't understand it all.
Harmon staggered to his chair and collapsed into it. But where did it come from?
Millennia ago, said Savi, the real old-style humans had a crude information ecology they called the Internet. Eventually, they decided to tame the Internet and created a thing called oxygen, not the gas, but artificial intelligences floating in and over and above the Internet, directing it, connecting it, tagging it, leading humans through it when they went hunting for people or information.
Fraxnet, said Demon. His hands were shaking, and he hadn't even accessed Farnet or AllNet tonight.
Savi nodded.
What led to Fraxnet?
Eventually, oxygen evolved into the noosphere, a logosphere, a planet-wide datasphere. But that wasn't enough for the post-humans. They connected this super-internet noosphere with the biosphere, the living components of the Earth. Every plant and animal and erg of energy on the planet which, when connected to the noosphere, created a complete and total information ecology, touching everything on, above, and within the Earth, a sort of
sentient omnisphere that lacked only self-awareness and identity. Then the post-humans foolishly gave it that self-awareness, not just designing an overriding artificial intelligence, but allowing it to evolve its own persona. This super-noosphere called itself Prospero. Does that name mean anything to either of you? Demon shook his head and looked at Harmon, but even though the older man knew how to read books, he also shook his head. It doesn't matter, said Savi. Suddenly the post-humans had an opponent that they couldn't control, and it wasn't over yet. The post-humans were using self-evolving programs and projects of other sorts as well, allowing their quantum computers to pursue their own goals. As impossible as it is to believe, they achieved stable wormholes. They achieved time travel, and they transported people. Old-style humans as guinea pigs, since they'd never risked their own immortal lives through time-space gates via quantum teleportation. What does that have to do with the Kalibani? Persisted Harmon, obviously still shaking the images from the AllNet out of his head. Savi smiled. The Prospero Noosphere entity either has an advanced set of irony or none at all. The sentient biosphere, he christened it Ariel, a sort of earth spirit, and together Ariel and Prospero created the Kalibani. They evolved a strain of humanity, not old style, not post, not Eloy, into that monster you saw on the cross tonight. Why? Asked Demon. He barely choked the single syllable out. Savi shrugged. Enforcers, Prospero is a peaceful entity, or so it likes to think, but its Kalibani are monsters, killers. Why? This time it was Harmon asking the question. To stop the Voynix, said the old woman, to chase the post-humans off the Earth before they could do more harm, to enforce whatever whim the Prospero and Ariel points of the Noosphere Trinity wish enforced. Demon tried to understand this. He failed. Finally he said, Why was the thing on a cross? It wasn't on the cross, said Savi. It was in the cross, recharging cradle. Harmon looked so pale that Demon thought the other man might be ill. Why did the posts create the Voynix? Oh, they didn't create the Voynix, said Savi. The Voynix came from somewhere else, serving someone else with their own agenda. I always thought they were machines, said Demon, like the other servitors. No, said Savi. Harmon looked out into the night. The rain had stopped and the lightning and thunder had moved over the horizon. A few stars were appearing between cloud tatters. The Kalibani keep the Voynix out of the basin here, he said. They're one of the things that keeps the Voynix away, agreed Savi. She sounded pleased, her voice holding a teacher's tone, as if one of her students had turned out not to be a total moron. But why haven't the Kalibani killed us? Asked Harmon. Our DNA, said Savi. Our what? Said Demon. Never mind, my darlings. Suffice it to say that I borrowed a snippet of each of your hair, and that, along with a lock of my own, has saved us all. I made a deal with Ariel, you see. Allow us to pass this once, and I promised to save the soul of the Earth. You've met the Ariel Earth entity? Asked Harmon. Well, not met him exactly, said Savi, but I've chatted with him across the Noosphere-Biosphere interface. We made a deal. Demon knew then that the old woman was truly mad. He caught Harmon's eye and saw the same conclusion there. It doesn't matter, said Savi. She plumped her pack like a pillow and lay back and closed her eyes. Get some sleep, my young darlings. You need to be rested tomorrow. Tomorrow, with any luck, we fly up, up, up to the orbit side lair. She was asleep and snoring before Harmon and Demon could exchange another worried glance. 37. Ilium and Olympus. As it turns out, I can't do it. I don't have the guts or balls or ruthlessness or perhaps courage. I can't kidnap Hector's child even to save Ilium, even to save the child himself, even to save my own life. It isn't dawn yet when I QT to Hector's huge home in Ilium. I was here just two evenings before when Morph, then as the now decapitated spearman Dolan, I followed Hector home in search of his wife and son. Since I know the layout from that visit, I QT'd directly to the nursery not far from Andromache's sleeping chamber. Hector's son, less than a year old, is in a wonderfully carved cradle with mosquito netting draped over it. Nearby sleeps the same nurse who was on the battlements of Troy with Andromache that evening when Hector accidentally frightened his son with the reflection in his polished war helmet. She's also fast asleep, reclining on a nearby couch, wearing a thin, diaphanous gown draped with all the complexity of an Aubrey Beardsley print. Even this sleeping gown is sashed under her breasts in the Greek and Trojan manner, showing how large and white the nurse's bosom is,
visible in the reflected light from the guardsmen's fire tripods on the terrace beyond.
I'd guessed earlier that she's a wet nurse for the baby. This is relevant, actually, because my plot hinges on being able to kidnap the baby with the nurse, leaving Andromache behind. After Aphrodite appears to her and tells her that the child is being kidnapped by the gods as punishment for unnamed failings on the part of the Trojans, and that if Hector wants the child, he can damned well come to Olympus to get him, blah, blah, blah. First, I have to gather up the baby and then grab the nurse. I suspect that she might be stronger than me and almost certainly more adept at fighting, so I'll taser her if I have to, although I don't want to. And then QT the two of them to that rapidly populating hill in ancient Indiana, find Neitenhelser, I haven't decided what I'm going to do with Patroclus, and convince the Skolik to watch over the infant and his nurse until I come back for them. Will Neitenhelser be up to the task of riding herd on this Trojan nurse for the days, weeks, or months until all this is over? Given the matchup of a 20th century male classics professor versus a Trojan wet nurse circa 1200 BC, I'd put my money on the nurse. And give my opponents good odds. Well, that's Neitenhelser's problem. My job is to find leverage against Hector, a way to convince him that he has to fight the gods, just as Patroclus' death was my best shot to enroll Achilles into this suicidal crusade. And that leverage is sleeping in front of me right now. Little Scamandrius, whom the people of Ilium lovingly call Astyanax, lord of the city, mules slightly in his sleep and rubs tiny fists against his reddened cheeks. Even though invisible under the Hades helmet, I freeze and watch the nurse. She sleeps on, although I know that an actual cry from the baby will almost certainly wake her. I don't know why I pull off the cowl of the Hades helmet, but I do, becoming visible to myself. There's no one else here except my two victims, and they'll be 10,000 miles away from here in a few seconds, unable to give my description to any Trojan police sketch artist. I tiptoe closer and remove the mosquito netting from above the infant. A breeze blows in from the distant sea and flutters both the terrace curtains and the gauzier material around the crib. Without a sound, the baby opens his blue eyes and looks right at me. Then he smiles at me, his kidnapper, although I thought little pre-toddlers were afraid of strangers, much less of strangers in their bedroom in the middle of the night. But what do I know about kids? My wife and I never had any, and all the students I taught over the years were actually partially or poorly formed adults, all gangly and bumpy and hairy and socially awkward and goofy-looking. I couldn't even have told you that babies less than a year old could smile. But Scamandrius is smiling at me. In a second he's going to start making noise, and I'll have to grab him, grab the nurse, QT us the hell out of here. Can I QT two other people along with me? We'll find out in a second. Then I have to come back and use my last 3 minutes of morphing time to steal Aphrodite's form and give my ultimatum to Andromache.
Will Hector's wife be hysterical? Will she weep and scream? I doubt it. After all, in recent years, she's seen Achilles kill her father and her seven brothers. She's watched her mother become Achilles' plunder and then die trying to give birth to her rapist's bastard. She's watched her home occupied and defiled, and still she's borne up. Not only borne up, but bore a healthy son to her husband, Hector. And now she has to watch Hector go out to battle every day, knowing in her heart that her beloved's fate has already been sealed by the cruel will of the gods. No, this is no weak woman. Even morphed as Aphrodite, I'd better keep a keen eye on Andromache's sleeves to make sure she doesn't have any daggers with which to greet the goddess's news of the kidnapping.
I actually reached for the baby, my fingers with their dirty nails just inches away from his pink flesh before drawing back. I can't do it. I can't do it. Stunned by my own impotence, even in the face of doom, everyone's doom, for even the Greeks will be punished through their victory, I stagger out of the nursery, not even bothering to pull the Hades helmet back on. I put my hand on the QT medallion, but pause. Where do I go? Whatever Achilles is doing, it doesn't really matter now. He can't conquer Olympus on his own, or even with the Achaean army, if the Trojans are still at war with them. In fact, my little charade with the man-killer may have been for nothing. Hector and his hordes may beat the Achaeans this very morning while Achilles is still ripping his hair out and screaming in grief over Patroclus' apparent murder. Achilles doesn't give a damn about the Trojans right now, and when Hector and the mystery man Athena promised Achilles to lead him to Hector, she said, to show him how to get to Olympus, don't come to him, will he know that my act was only an act? Probably. Then the real Athena will visit Achilles to see what's wrong and will protest her innocence to the fleet-footed man-killer, and perhaps, just perhaps, the Iliad will get back on track. It doesn't matter. This whole idiot plan is finished. So is Thomas Hockenberry, Ph.D. Past time, probably. But where to go until the violent muse or the reawakened Aphrodite finally find me? Go visit Nightenhelser and pissed off Patroclus? See how long it takes the gods to track my quantum trail once they understand what I've done? Tried to do? No, that would just bring doom down on Nightenhelser. Let him stay there in 1200 B.C. Indiana and procreate with the lovely Indian maidens. Perhaps start a university and teach classics, although most of the classical tales haven't happened yet. And good luck to him about Patroclus, whom I have no urge to taser again just to drag back to Achilles' tent. April Fool, I could have my 3-minute morph, Athena, say. Here's your friend back, Achilles, no hard feelings? No, I'll leave them alone there in Indiana. Where to go? Olympus? The thought of the muse hunting for me there, of Zeus and his radar eyes returning, of Aphrodite awakening? Well, not to Olympus. Not tonight. I think of one place and visualize it and touch the QT medallion and twist it and go there before I can change my mind. I'm visible, and Helen sees me at once in the soft light of candles. She rises on one arm on her cushions and says, Hockenberry? I stand in her bedchamber and say nothing. I don't know why I'm here. If she calls her guards or even comes toward me with that dagger, I feel too tired to fight, too tired even to flee on the QT. I don't even think to wonder why her bedchamber is illuminated by candles at 4:30 in the morning. She comes toward me, but not with the dagger. I'd forgotten how beautiful Helen of Troy is, her svelte, soft figure in the transparent gown making Scamandrius' busty nurse look just lumpy and squat by comparison. Hockenberry, she says softly with that sweet pronunciation of my name, so difficult to say in ancient Greek. End of side 12.